If we got here on time, could we quit 5-10 minutes early?
We most definitely could.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, February 25th, 2015. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government, and I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 5036 relating to the Secretary of State. Mr. Bender, anything to add at this point?
I would just like to remind committee members that if you would like to look on to the presentation and find it on OLIS, that would be in February 23rd's meeting date under meeting materials. It would be the third item after the agenda labeled HB 5036 SOS presentation.
And you said the 23rd?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Taylor and Ms. Herkert.
Hey, good afternoon, Co-Chair Steiner, Hayward, and Smith, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Herkert, and I am the Director of the Secretary of State's Archives Division. And I'm going to continue with our presentation from yesterday, and we are on slide 69, which is our package for the 2015-17 biennium. And package 121 is for phase two of the archives shelving project. We completed phase one. And as you can see in the slide, the white paneled bottoms are the compact shelving, and it allowed us to gain 44% more over the traditional shelving we had in that area. And because we could use the existing shelving, we saved $125,000 in having to buy additional shelving. So we really were able to use everything that we had in place. The floor loads were found to meet the code, so we did not have to do any kind of structural work either on it. The newly gained space is quickly filling up with records transfers that we had put on hold prior to completing phase one, from the transfer records from the Oregon University system as it sunsets, and for records from other state and local government agencies that we have identified through the retention scheduling process that have a permanent or historical value to the citizens. Phase two will allow us to complete the first floor stack area and gain an additional 42% of storage capacity. We anticipate if the package is not funded that we will run out of space sometime next biennium, probably around mid-biennium, which would then leave the historical records at risk because they will not be in a climate-controlled environment, and most likely they won't be able to be accessed either.
So, Ms. Herkert, just let me understand that. You will run out of space without this next biennium. What's the long-term plan at this point? And I understand that more records are coming in electronically now, which has different storage requirements and different challenges. Maintaining electronic media for future use is in some ways harder than paper with changing technology. But are you in a place right now where you could talk to us about what that looks like three biennia from now?
Coach Harris, Steiner Hayward. Yes, this is a rolling phase out of the shelving, and this would just complete the first floor. The second floor, we would also anticipate the completion of the second floor will give us an additional numbers that we got on the first floor. So we should be fine with that. Once the compact shelving has been rolled out, we should be fine. As you said, most of the stuff now is we're trying to figure out ways of accepting electronic records as permanent records. And one of the things that we have done is as long as they can tell us that they have these records in a certified electronic records management system and in certain formats. So, for example, instead of having 50 formats of audio files, we request that they be sent to us in an MP3 format. Mm-hmm. So that down the road, if MP3 goes away, we only have to migrate one format as opposed to 50 formats. But once we complete the shelving project, we should have enough storage for a long time.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying.
Okay, the customer service KPM is the one that was shown yesterday by Corporations Division. We also did our survey in May and had the exact same results as Corporations found is a little downtick in the information category. Our KPM number one, which is electronic access to public information, When we developed the KPM, we thought that more information we could put make available online, the more we would see the use of the archives increase, but at what rate? We were not sure, so we set a conservative 20% as a base, eventually increasing to 30%. And if you look at the chart, we clearly set the bar way too low. In 1993, the last year that the archives did not have a web presence, we fulfilled almost 7,000 requests. And the only way that people knew about what we had or how to get it was word of mouth or knowledge of what an archives was or did. In 2014, 20 years after we have been on the web, we have had over 315,000 requests fulfilled or made for our records. 96% of those are accessed and answered with information that already exists on the web. And the records ready, the other 4% represents close to 11,000 requests that were answered by our reference staff, which is nearly 4,000 more requests than were made in 1993. So clearly, the more records that we can make accessible, the more information will be accessed and used. The other part of this KPM is our use of social media. In 2012, we actively began using Facebook and Twitter. Our purpose was to feature a different photo or record of the day, and we've opened up the archives to a whole new audience, and an audience that has more than doubled in the past year. And the audience that we find on Facebook and Twitter, we have 3,000 likes, or 2,000 likes, but that doesn't mean that's everybody who's hitting the page. And it also, what we find is if we miss a day, including the weekends, we hear about it.
Pretty cool. If nobody else has seen it, you really ought to look at these things. I follow you guys, and I think it's super cool. I love seeing it come up in my feed.
Thank you. Engaging Oregonians, and I'm going to, in the interest of time, skip over most of the slides, but there's two areas that I'd like to showcase our efforts in engaging Oregonians. The first is the Constitution. We have begun a public funding and engaging the public to fund and regularly display the original Constitution. The Constitution is the people's document, and it should be on display on a regular basis. However, it is in dire need of some conservation, and it needs a proper display case that is secure and contains the proper environment so that it's not harmed while on display.
Certainly, Mr. Co-Chair.
So what are we doing on that?
Kidding. The co-chair, Senator Hayward, co-chair Smith,
We're getting there.
Yep.
I'm being patient.
Yep.
Sorry.
You're jumping the gun, my friend.
I keep jumping, sorry.
That's okay. In the early 1980s, Oregon school children raised enough money to regild the Oregon Pioneer. And so that gave us the idea is to give the people of Oregon, including Oregon school children, the opportunity to preserve and regularly display the Oregon's original Constitution. We tested the waters the weekend that we had the Constitution on display about a week and a half ago, and the response was overwhelmingly positive. And today we went out with a press release engaging the school children, and I've already heard back from a couple of newspapers that are really excited about getting this underway. The second is the interest that we've had in the past year about our records and access to them from television, radio, and the like. The television station TLC, which airs Who Do You Think You Are?, a show that finds the ancestors of celebrities, came to the archives last April with Kelsey Grammer to film him looking at the probate record of his 3 times great-grandfather, Joseph Dimmock. They used the Early Oregonians database to locate his ancestor, came to the archives to look at the records, and then went to Monroe to put his feet, as he said, on the ancestral donation land claim. The producers of the show were so impressed with the ease of locating records, the customer service that they received, and of course the beautiful archives building, that they returned in December to film another episode on a celebrity to be named later. I can give you a hint. They are from the family of the G and MGM, and the episode will air on April 5th. In addition, We had a Johnstown, Pennsylvania news crew come to the archives to follow the journey of a resident who discovered one of her ancestors' cremains were at the state hospital. Using the records of in our holdings, they were able to look at the admissions register, the death register, and the death certificate before going to the hospital to recover his remains. Slides 75 and 76, I think, are pretty self-explanatory, so I'm going to let you look at those. And then, finally, today we're providing all the services that I've mentioned with three less employees than we had 25 years ago, but three more additional programs. We continue to grow and evolve, and most people think of an archives as dark, dusty warehouses of records that only a privileged few can access. The Oregon State Archives couldn't be further from that thought. Preserving the records of government is very important and something we pride ourselves in doing. However, providing access to that information is equally important, and I think we can also take pride in our role of making government information more accessible and transparent. And thank you, and if you have any additional questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Herkert? Okay, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. We really appreciate it. And I will say personally that I really do appreciate the efforts you're making to engage Oregonians in some of these more creative ways with social media and things like that, because people do need to understand that this is not boring, dusty paper, that it's living history, and that as Oregonians, we have a lot of very important information about ourselves and our state under your care, and I thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Mr. Taylor, who's next? Mr. Blackmer.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Steiner, Hayward, and Smith. My name is Gary Blackmer. I'm Director of the Secretary of State Audits Division. You'll have to pardon my hay fever. I'm working my way through it, so I may have to take a drink or cough a little bit. Let me kind of, before we start, say that there were at least three questions raised on Monday that I'm going to answer as I go through my presentation. One on attracting and retaining auditors, one on following up on our audit recommendations, and then another on IT and data security audits. So let's get started. Just to give you a quick overview, our budget, we rely upon about $20.2 million and other funds to pay for what we're requesting is 73 full-time equivalent positions. The $20.2 million comes from our assessments of other agencies, and we charge those officers, departments, boards a share of the full costs of our audits. We also have charge a direct bill that we charge to a number of agencies like ODOT and the universities based upon the hours worked. So it's more of a direct charge on them. And between those two, our total budget is $26.3 million. If it turns out that we don't spend all of our money, then the share of assessment goes back to each of those agencies. So we've done that regularly in the past years. So just as an overview, we conduct our audits in accordance with government audit standards that were developed and updated by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, the GAO. And we think that those standards are really critical because they provide an assurance to the public that our audits are done independently, objectively, professionally, with due care, that we have highly competent auditors, and that we have a quality control process. And we also bring in outside, the National State Auditors Association sends auditors out to look at our compliance with those standards every 3 years. So this might be a good point to talk about what we do to develop a good workforce. We work toward attracting auditors through a number of ways. We have an outreach committee that goes out to the job fairs, to universities, to university classes to talk about opportunities in auditing. We've got connections with faculty from various universities and professional groups like the Oregon Program Evaluators Network. So they have a lot of talent in terms of analysis, accountants, and so forth that can be kind of tuned into what we do. One thing I should mention is that government accounting gets about 2 weeks of training in a typical accountant major's a four-year degree. And it's a much different and more complex accounting than business accounting. So we end up doing a lot of in-house training of the accountants to understand funds and all of the compliance and granting responsibilities and reporting that's involved in that. We do look for accounting majors for our financial auditors. For our IT auditors, we're looking obviously for people with majors in information technology. What we found is accountants who actually are interested in doing IT audits, so they bring both those skills. And ultimately, those audits are important for providing assurance that the computer systems that are gathering all the data that our financial audits are dependent upon are accurate. So we look at kind of that marriage of accounting and financial activities in terms of setting our priorities. Performance auditors, we're looking for a master's in public administration or essentially any degree related to a state service. Mm-hmm. So it could be social service type activities, engineering, environmental sciences, a variety of different programs like that. So that's who we're looking for. In terms of retention, we've done a lot of things to try and retain people. And frankly, as Mr. Taylor said on Monday, we have a lot of people coming from Portland, and the commute is one of the things that it makes it a challenge. There's a big talent pool out there, but we've done things like offer 410 schedules, allow teleworking and certain limited cases, but ultimately 90% of the auditing is here in Salem. So we've kind of kicked around the idea of a Portland office, but it never pencils out in terms of where the work is. So, but we do have things that we're doing, like we've got some instructional design developed that helps our auditors, new auditors, get up to speed more quickly. We've redesigned our performance audit process to streamline it. We've really built a teamwork atmosphere, and I think we've got a really positive organization. If you wander out into the mall in the summertime, you might see one of our bocce tournaments at lunchtime. But I think most importantly, the thing that we sell these auditors is they really are making a difference to Oregonians, that our audits have an impact, that they see the changes that are happening as a result of our audit recommendations. And I think it gives them a feeling of satisfaction and meaning that we can't replace with anything else. So in terms of money, it may have an impact, but I think ultimately it's those kinds of values that give them the fulfillment they're looking for. But ultimately, we hire the smartest people we can find. We grow them to be change agents in the agencies they go visit. And it's a great training pool for people to become leaders. And there's no better place to learn how to be a good manager than from the errors of other managers you're auditing. So we tend to learn from other people's mistakes rather than our own. So it's a good job, career path for people to take. So let me kind of walk through the different sections. And I was asked, what are the FTE breakdowns? Literally half of our audit hours go toward our financial audits. That the financial audits represent about 50% of our audit hours or 50% of our FTE. And that sounds like a lot, and it is, because we're looking at over 400 different accounts in a fiscal year. That represents over $22 billion in revenues, about the same amount in expenditures, assets and liabilities, you know, assets maybe $40 billion, and looking at the reliability of that information. So we're going out and doing tests in all the agencies, and they literally leave in June and come back in April. And so that's essentially what our financial auditors are working on for 9 months of the year. Information and technology audits, oh, that's about 35 FTE if you want to divide us up just from an FTE standpoint.
Hold on a moment.
Sure.
Mr. Blackman,
in these financial audits, how far down does the review go? Does it get to the point where there's actually a reconciliation between, say, an invoice and the issuing of a payment?
Well, we're looking to make sure that the agencies are doing those reconciliations. So we would expect that. But we do
sample.
Yeah, we do sampling, and we do various tests based upon risks. So if it's a major account and we see that the controls and activities around it have some, you know, we have some concerns about it, we'll go in and do some tests, and we'll actually look at case files of individuals to see if they're if things are done properly and get down to individual testing.
That, again, is all in compliance with GAO standards.
That's correct, yes. And so on the financial side, we're also looking to make sure that they're following accounting rules as well.
Got it.
So, information technology audits represents 5 FTE, about 8% of our resources. And in those, we're looking at the information technology systems, the application controls, and security. So is the data being entered properly? Is it being processed properly? Is the data coming out accurate? So we're looking to make sure that that's done properly. And we're down at essentially the code level in many of these programs, testing to see that the transactions are properly done by the computer system. We're also looking at security. What kind of protections do they have of the data? What kinds of protections do they have of the equipment? So we're looking at all of those aspects, and we issue a public report that talks about those things we can talk about publicly, but Oregon Revised Statutes also allow us to issue a confidential report to the agency to point out those security concerns we've got. And it's rare that we don't do an audit that has that. It's rare that we do an audit that does not have one of those security memos with it. So it is a real concern for us, and it's a growing concern, just because many of these systems, they've been plugged into the internet, and we don't know that all the protections have been put in place.
Thank you, Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Blackman. The number that jumps off the page at me is the $12.9 billion in liabilities that you audit. Liabilities or debt?
That's correct.
So the state and the state agencies have at least $12.9 billion in debt.
That's correct.
Thank you.
We look at many of the state systems there, and we've looked at a variety of them: Department of Motor Vehicles, the State Data Center, the Medicaid Management Information System, the Employment Department, Forestry Information Management. So we try to get around to look at all these systems, but there's many more than we could ever look at.
Can I just circle back?
Sure.
I want to make sure I understand something that Senator Whitsitt just asked you. When you talk about debt, you're talking about debt associated with bonds that are issued in accordance with Oregon's constitution and statute.
That's correct.
Is that correct? Okay. I just want to make sure I understand that. Thank you.
Yes. Performance audits represents about 27 FTE. And in that one, we are looking at management practices in the agencies. From our perspective, we see what's in statute, what the legislature adopts, governor signs, is the expectation for that agency, and we're looking at how well that agency is achieving those expectations, and we're looking at ways the agency can do that better. So to the degree that we're looking for bottlenecks, we're looking for inefficiencies, we're looking for ways to be more effective in serving what the desired goals are, the mission of the agency. So we kind of talk about it as a mission level kind of a focus for our audits. And ultimately, that's what affects the public the most. If we can figure out ways to help the public get better services at less cost, then we're able to serve more people and get greater results from it. So we're focused as much as we can on where agencies meet the public and figuring out ways to stretch those dollars.
So, certainly, Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. You actually piqued my interest a little bit. The debt would not be just constitutionally authorized debt. It would also include like lottery revenue bonds that are not our statutory, and highway bonds that are statutory, that sort of thing.
I know it would include highway bonds. I don't entirely know about probably the lottery bonds too. I'd have to go back and check.
Lottery bonds are revenue bonds that are statutorily authorized.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
I think I said constitutional and statutory. So yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
I should mention we are producing a financial condition of the state of Oregon as we speak, and we will be pulling all this information together and reporting it as we do every 2 years. So that'll be out in another month or two. So,
thank you. Look forward to seeing that.
We really focus on best practices for state agencies and our performance audits. What are the best ideas we can find around the country that actually work, and what are the things that Oregon can implement to achieve those same good results?
So, Mr. Blackmore, I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but I want to understand something about that. Best practices in government or best practices in both government and the private sector?
Chair Steiner-Hayward, it would be both if the business practices could be applied.
Great. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, the most important question I think to ask is what we audit, and we try to assess what the risks are in the state, where the dollars go, and put our most resources where the most dollars and the highest risks are. So that's one of the strategies that we've used to try to get the greatest value for Oregonians and achieve our own mission.
Wait, can you go back one more time?
Sure.
You didn't really talk about that last sentence. Said we're constantly looking for potential issues that we can audit, and we accumulate many more than we could ever complete. Could you talk about that a little bit, please? Like,
sure.
What kinds of things are you not able to complete, and how concerned should we be about those?
Chair Steiner-Hayward, our auditors are going out, and they're always looking for the risks or opportunities in an organization. And they're assessing those and picking the highest risk ones, the ones that are of most concern. But there's always others out there. So we're not losing those. We're accumulating those with the idea that we can always come back and get right in and focus on that risk without having to do another assessment. So we've probably got about 150 potential audit ideas out there that we could do.
Personally, I don't want to speak for my co-chair, but it's the first I've really heard it in this way. Or maybe I just don't remember last year because I was so new. But I guess I'd like to understand that a little bit better, and maybe we can have an opportunity to visit about that offline. Because I'd like to understand what you think we could get back in return for dealing with the ones that you haven't been able to deal with in terms of efficiencies and making sure that we're spending taxpayer dollars more wisely and all those kinds of things, running in the best practices. So I'd be interested to have a separate conversation with you about that. Thank you.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Blackmore.
About 2 FTE are spent on our other areas of municipal audit monitoring and hotline investigations. We are responsible for ensuring that the private CPA firms that audit municipal governments, which are cities, counties, and special districts, are all getting the audits that are required. If they have over $500,000 in expenditures or revenues, they're required to have a financial audit. So we make sure that those audits are done properly. Just in contrast, the state of Washington sends its own auditors out. The Washington State Auditor has about 350 auditors total spread around the state. They do the financial audits for all those local governments. In Oregon, we've chosen to go more of a private enterprise approach, and we depend upon the local government to hire a CPA firm to do an audit, and then we just make sure that that audit's done according to government audit standards. So we study about 100 to 200 of those audits a year, and we go out and look at the work papers of the CPA firms, and if we see some serious deficiencies, we'll report them to the Board of Accountancy for action. So we do provide a certain quality control on those audits. So, and it's something that we can do literally with like 1.5 FTE or 1 FTE. And that's kind of where we've found it's most efficient. And we've generally been quite satisfied with the quality of work that the CPAs have done.
Okay. No, Co-Chair.
Certainly.
So not on this 4%, but on the other 96% that we've been discussing, those findings, I assume that they're presented to the agency. I assume they're put on your web page. I assume LFO staff receives a copy?
Co-Chair Smith, yes to all those.
Let me ask this question, and I've been around here a long time. I don't recall ever having someone from the audits division present to a committee a finding of one of the audits. For example, one of the most recent audits that was completed was on TANF. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what it would be, and I'm just thinking out loud to the committee, I wonder what the result would be if you folks came and actually presented to the Ways and Means Subcommittee on your findings and allowed the committee to ask you the findings.
Co-Chair Smith, I don't know if I can speculate on what would happen, but we do make presentations to the Joint Committee on Legislative Audits and Information Management Technology.
Right.
Yeah, that's a little different than
right.
I think.
Right. I'm just thinking, I'm just wondering, and I'm just speculating, then we need to move on because of time, but I just wonder what type of action would occur if we as a subcommittee were allowed to hear directly from the people who committed or conducted the audit.
Because we do hear directly from the CFO's office. That's the CFO person who's associated with.
But he'd be, I manage multiple nonprofits
audit
as part of our company that I work with. And the CPA, when they do their financial review, they report back to the board. And they say, here are the findings, here's what we, here's the management letter, et cetera. I wonder at some point in time if we should have a conversation with the big dogs, and I wonder what the results would be. Let's move on.
Thank you. The other is hotline investigations. We have a team of about a dozen auditors who meet every 2 weeks to talk about the calls that are coming in, kind of triage them and assign them for preliminary investigation. And ultimately, if it's bona fide, we go further and issue a report. So there were, I think, 185 calls last year that we followed through on in that way.
Are you going to show us anything about those calls, Mr. Blackmore?
We produce a report every year. I didn't bring one with me.
Okay. Could you just send that to Mr. Bender, please, so it can
sure.
be added to OLIS for today's record? Thank you very much.
One of the biggest budget challenges has to do with the direct bill that I talked about, that we are actually asked to estimate what our direct bill will be almost 3 years in advance when we put our budget together. And it can be rather challenging to be nimble as an audit agency if we can't anticipate, if we have that kind of a lead time. For example, ODOT is a major agency that we feel it's appropriate to have them budget for our audits before we come in, because it's kind of adding insult to injury to say, we're going to do an audit, it's going to cost you money, you're going to have to cut elsewhere to pay for us, and then you're going to get some bad news in the end. So we try to budget in advance and let them know we're going to be doing these audits, and we try to have kind of a steady state for those things. Oregon University system was easier for us to budget for because generally there are things happening in the universities. Now that they've been split up in individual universities that are direct bill, it makes it a little harder for us to anticipate when they're going to need us or when we need to go in to conduct an audit. So that's one of the big challenges we have, because if we aren't budgeting for it in advance, then they've got to cut elsewhere to pay for our audit. If we anticipate we're going to do an audit and we don't, then our assessment comes short. So it's just one of those odd things about assessments mixed with direct bills. Let me talk a little bit about our policy package. We are requesting to reclass three positions to higher than entry level among our auditors, and also to create three new positions. And this has to do with the fact that we are doing things differently than we have done for the past 10 or 15 years. We are doing a lot more of the big data analysis. We're looking at individual case files, but we're also looking at a million records at a time for outliers. So we're asking our auditors to be more savvy about using sophisticated analytical software. In the past, we had a lot of entry-level positions, I think, that operated 10 key machines with tapes, and they were adding numbers and sending them out to the field to go through case files and add numbers. Now we're doing a lot of it with sophisticated computer programs, and so we need less of that lower level and more just a higher level analytical auditor. So that's the first part of it. The second part of it is to ask for three new positions. These two of the three we would like to have for an extra IT audit team. Just as I've said earlier, we have concerns about security and all the information systems that are out there. And from our perspective, we feel like we're not able to provide enough coverage. With two teams that we have now with a manager overseeing it, having a third team is a substantial increase in that workload. And IT auditors, we really need to train. We do face the market competition that we can't necessarily compete with major firms for IT auditors, so we tend to bring people in and train them. So we couldn't ask for more because we wouldn't be able to train up that quickly, but we think we could handle two more quite easily and be able to cover more of the state. The third position would be a performance auditor. That was initially what we were seeking because we just get more requests than we can handle. As I've said, we have many more audit ideas and needs than we can possibly accomplish. This would be a move in that direction. We are constantly kind of getting pushed in terms of more accounting and auditing standards that we have to comply with. So when I said sometimes we're looking at 100 municipal audits, sometimes we're looking at 200. When we look at 200, it's because there's new accounting or auditing rules, and we need to spread our coverage farther to make sure all the CPAs are picking it up. But regularly, we're getting new and more complex auditing and accounting rules that we have to apply. So depending on where the next vacancy might be, this could be a financial auditor for a while till we get up to speed on the new standards. But just growing our capacity in general would be very appreciative for our office, and I think it would definitely have an impact. Just to give you a little history of our staffing, there's an interesting story behind this, which was that we started getting more auditors to conduct performance and IT audits in fiscal year 85-87. We grew to 90 auditors at that point. Since then, we've had a slow decrement of auditors down to the 70 that we had in the current fiscal year. And part of the reason we were able to accomplish that was the automation, the computerization of a lot of our financial records and the ability for us to use the big data tools to do the analysis. When you saw the seven IT that were dedicated to audits in the Secretary of State's office, that is part of the reason we're able to get by with 20 less auditors. Mm-hmm. The other thing I should point out is that we started in 85-87 not doing any performance audits, or at least a very small proportion of what Secretary of State did back then was performance audits. So it was nearly all financial at that point. We grew to 90, adding the performance side of it. Now we're back down to 70, but we're doing IT audits, performance audits, and financial audits. So we're doing much more with fewer resources, and we're doing it smarter. So, to the degree that three more auditors would be greatly appreciated to help us kind of start reversing the trend and maybe showing a little love for auditors for a change.
Madam Chair, next you're going to be pitching for love for actuaries.
Let's not get away out of our excuse.
Let me talk a little bit about our results, the dollar impact of our audits. As you can see, we have some really great years, and we have some other years where we hit our goals, and that's kind of the way it is. We aren't necessarily going out just looking for dollars. We're really looking for ways that we can benefit Oregonians. Mm-hmm. From my perspective, if we can show a way to help more kids graduate from high school, that can be equally as important as saving money,
yep. mm-hmm.
stretching yep. the dollars that we have. So this is kind of, we always would like to be able to more than pay for ourselves, and this is like a 5-to-1 ratio here, but we know that the icing on the cake is actually providing better services to Oregonians. So we keep this in mind, but we also don't want to forget that we can do better for Oregonians in the way we look at our audits. The other returning on, as I said, we're returning about, in this case, the costs, it's about $5 in 13-14 for every dollar spent on performance audits. And our target is 10. We've had years with much higher. So we kind of keep that in mind. We try and shoot for it, but we don't necessarily find what we hope to every time we go out and do an audit. Sometimes we find agencies that are actually pretty tight, and I guess to the degree that we're getting through the Great Recession, I think a lot of money has been wrung out of agency budgets, and it's a little harder to find those dollars like we normally would.
So let me ask you a question, Mr. Blackmore, and I'd like to ask some of my colleagues who've been doing Ways and Means longer than me about this. Historically, we look at KPMs on an annual or a biennial basis, but these last two slides have led me to wonder whether in situations such as these, we ought to be looking at a 3-year rolling average or something like that, because mm-hmm. you're going to have some years where you wring $65 out and years where you wring out $5. And so I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about that. It doesn't have to be now. It can be when you guys come back in phase two and we're talking a little bit more about your KPMs. But I'm also interested, I mean, at some level, I agree with you. You know, if we've got agencies that are using every dollar as wisely as possible, you're not going to, I mean, a low number is actually probably not necessarily a bad thing. It's not that you guys aren't doing your jobs. It's that the other agencies aren't doing theirs. So, you know, I'd like to a little bit of thinking among committee members about whether we ought to think about reformulating some of the KPMs a little bit differently for you guys.
Chair Steiner Hayward, that I'd love to have a conversation on measures.
Okay.
I think there's ways that they can be very meaningful.
We revamped a bunch of agencies' KPMs last biennium, and maybe it's time to take a look at yours. So thank you. We'll do that.
Our fourth KPM is around the percentage of recommendations implemented, and this responds to a question that I believe was asked on Monday. This is what we do. Senator Johnson actually asked it, as I recall. Every year, we follow up on our audit recommendations to see what actions the agency has taken. And we engage with them. They explain what they've done and the status that the recommendation is in. And if we feel like it's not clear or we need more information, we'll be talking to the managers that filled out essentially a survey that we send out to them. I should also mention that the Secretary of State has been calling the agency heads to ask what, and visiting, calling them into her office to ask them what they've been doing to implement our recommendations, which has been a welcome addition to our follow-up. But we also conduct selective reviews where we go out to the agency and actually ask them to show us how they've implemented those recommendations.
Senator Johnson, depending on what she asks, I may have a question too.
I guess the question I have is that some of your findings may be so significant that they would involve risk management or DAS. And I would love you to elaborate whether or not you use the power of DAS to help motivate agency heads if they have had a significant finding in their management letter or in an audit.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Smith, Senator Johnson, we actually meet monthly with Michael Jordan to talk through kind of the status of our audits and issues that we see between what's happening with the agency. So we've had a good working relationship with DAS on that aspect of it as well. So we generally get a pretty good implementation rate because we have really pushed to show the advantages and benefits of following through on our recommendations, which one of the things that we challenge our auditors to do is it's easy to find a problem. It's not so easy to find the solution. So we also look for the solution and put it into our audit reports so that the agency has a path toward that solution, and it makes the implementation a lot easier. So that's part of the reason why we have such a high implementation rate, is we really don't just say you've got a problem, you need to fix it. We say you have a problem, we've tracked it down to its root causes, and this is what you can do to fix it.
So I'd like to follow on to some extent to Senator Johnson and say two things. The first is, you know, I've read audits and I've read, I mean, on the medical front, I read JACO reports, right, when JACO comes and reviews hospitals. And they've got major findings and they got minor findings. And so 90% is, it's a blended number, right? And I'd be kind of curious to see a breakdown, if it's easy to do, between things that you really think have to get done versus things that, yeah, you could improve things in this arena, but it's not mission critical, right? Because I think there really are, if I'm understanding what you're saying, that you guys are really looking hard at everything, which is great, and making recommendations. But some of them are kind of, yeah, it would be nice, and some of them are, you darn better do this, right? Yeah, okay, I see you nodding.
Chair Senator, yes.
Okay, so it would be great to see some split. But I want to circle back then to what Co-Chair Smith said, which is not only, as Senator Johnson said, the threat, if you will, although it shouldn't be a threat, of DAS coming in with risk management, but also the other subcommittees that have oversight over these agencies, because frankly, as a member of the Human Services Subcommittee, and I won't presume to speak for my co-chair on that committee, I would love to know if one of the agencies or a division within an agency that we're talking about there isn't following through, especially on major recommendations. And if not, why not? So I'd be interested to have us think about that a little bit more.
Chair Senator Hayward, I agree. And actually, one of the nice things that can come out of it is what the agency has been doing mm-hmm. to implement. Because mm-hmm. I think sure. people have a right. perception that government is unresponsive, inflexible,
right.
unchanging.
Right.
And what we find as auditors is that we see change happening and we see responsiveness. And
I think that's documented by your numbers on the past several slides. But I think we need to figure out maybe a more interactive relationship.
Just one final thing we do in terms of follow-up is we do issue reports on those when we do the reviews. But when we're going back to do a regular audit, like Oregon Youth Authority, we will look at past recommendations to see what they've done in response to it. So there are cases where we're looking at what happened previously to see that they are following through and report that again in the audit. So there's like at least four different ways that we follow through.
Keep going.
Okay. Some of the things that we've been doing, like I said, we've been using the most modern audit tools and methods, looking at performance management as a mechanism for us to do our own work, but also to emphasize to agency managers that, you know, using measures, doing the continuous improvement, doing lean work, those are all things that they can do to improve their processes. So we're incorporating those kinds of strategies into the way we put our audit reports out. The other important thing that we've been doing, especially with the Great Recession, was when we're not seeing savings in a particular agency, we're seeing opportunities for better services by finding the gaps where people fall through between agencies. And we're looking for ways to better coordinate state agencies, because we don't necessarily want to stick with the scope of an agency if some of the problems are caused elsewhere. So we tend to expand our scope to look across agencies and look for ways to build more collaborative working relationships to help the public. Some of the things that we've been concerned about, I talked about, you know, looking at the security of the state computer systems, making sure that the internal controls for all of our financial transactions are properly managed, making sure we're on top of fraud hotline calls and conducting good investigations. We're always vigilant for fraud in the audits that we're doing, and we really want to be able to pick those most critical audit areas to serve the public and protect public assets and resources. So these are in your materials, but I'm going to kind of quickly just mention them. We did an audit of emergency management, looking at the organization first, because that seemed to be the barrier to them actually accomplishing their mission. So we plan to go back and do a part two on that. We looked at the 17 health regulatory boards, which were what we saw as a risk area for the state, because they do have very important roles that they play in the health and safety of Oregonians. And we generally found that they did a good job of handling complaints and their licensing processes. We looked at housing community development, which was a really innovative approach. We took a model that the Government Accountability Office has been using at the federal level around fragmentation, overlap, and duplication, and applied that here in the state of Oregon. We were the first agency anywhere in the country to use their methodology. As a result of that, they asked us to partner with them in an audit that they're doing of looking again at fragmentation, overlap, and rental assistance. And they're going to be issuing a report next summer. Just to give you a sense, we completed our field work last summer for them, and their audit will be out next summer. So we work at a different pace than they do. And then the last one I'd like to kind of mention was we looked at the E-Road system, which is a test that the Bureau of the ODOT wanted to do of a device that can plug into a truck to track its travel around the state in lieu of them filling out paper forms of their movement. For weight mile computations. This is a system that was developed in New Zealand, and they wanted assurance that it was accurate and secure because the truckers didn't necessarily want to share where they were going with competitors, so they wanted to make sure that whatever data that was transmitted from this device was secure. And so we essentially did a test, and we audited the Amazon cloud where the system operated and looked at the devices and matched them up with the paper documents and actually found that they were more accurate than the tracking because it was a GPS-driven device. So we felt like that was a pretty innovative thing that we did, and it served ODOT's needs because they wanted some independent verification that this was a possible way that truckers could be able to track it without having to do the paperwork.
Senator Whitsitt.
Mr. Blackmer, could you tell us how to find that housing and community development audit?
Chair Steiner Hayward Smith, Senator Whitsitt, it's on our website. I can send you a link to it if you would like.
Would you please? And
sure.
Do you also have you recently audited the Energy Department?
Senator Whitsitt, not recently. About 2 years ago, we did one. No. Must have been 3 years ago. But we do a financial audit every year there, looking at LIHEAP. It's got federal funds that come in, so we're looking at it from that standpoint.
I was looking for more of an efficiency or forensic type thing. So.
In closing, what I'd like to emphasize is that we're doing a lot more with less resources than we had 30 years ago. We continue to produce mandated audits on time. I think our performance audits are some of the most innovative in the country, and we really are able to induce change in agencies. Our IT audits serve a critical function to identify risks and problems in computations, and our hotline is there 24/7 for anyone with concerns about fraud, waste, or abuse in Oregon government.
Great. Thank you. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to ask a question about the hotline. We have passed whistleblower legislation in the past. We try to make it easier for people, including state employees, to report something that they're concerned about. Is there a separate line called a whistleblower line, or is there one single hotline that, even if there are multiple numbers, it goes into just one line?
co-chairs, Representative Nathanson, we have a contract with a national firm that allows us to have 24/7 access to a line. It's on our website. We have posters that we send out to all the agencies. It's on the back of all of our business cards that we pass out. It's on the bottom of our emails. And so we try to promote that to employees with every interaction we have with them. And it's a single phone number. They can also, there's a website where they can do it online and put the information in that way.
Follow up?
Yeah, certainly.
I want to be really clear for people who are listening. You said we several times. It's not just your departments or your office's hotline. Is this the one single line for the entire state?
Representative Nathanson, yes, this is the one single line for the entire state. And just so I get the number right, it's 1-800-336-8218. And you, if you go to http://fraud.oregon.gov, you can get to our hotline online or come to the Secretary of State's website. It's on the front page of the Secretary of State's website.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Blackmer? Moving right along. Thank you, Mr. Blackmer, very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
We appreciate the work your division's doing. Next.
He looks like an auditor.
What does an auditor look like? I can't say
That's
that.
That's what an auditor looks like.
Well, but Representative Taylor's an auditor. She's looking like Mr. Blackmer.
They look like her, too.
They have a look.
May I please speak somewhat out of turn?
Certainly.
I just would like to say that we are very lucky here at the state to have Gary Blackmer be our state auditor. Mr. Blackmer was my very first boss 16 years ago almost at the City of Portland. He trained me, taught me pretty much everything I know, and we are extremely lucky that he is willing to get in that car and drive down here every day. So
that's awesome.
Great. All right. Next.
Great. Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jim Williams. I'm the Elections Director for the Secretary of State. As an elections administrator at the state and county levels in three other states before coming to Oregon, I admired Oregon's nationally recognized election system for years. So it's a personal honor to now be a part of this great system, and I'm excited today about the opportunity to present the Elections Division budget to you today. In the interest of time, I will summarize the presentation as much as possible. I won't necessarily read every slide, but will instead focus on the highlights. I, too, will answer some questions that have come up in the prior meetings this week as we get to the appropriate slides. The main goal of the Elections Division is to ensure accurate, secure, efficient, transparent, and accessible elections in Oregon. And in doing so, we are perhaps the most visible of all of the divisions in the Secretary of State's office. This slide shows our budget request for this year. General funds, $8.5 million. Other funds, $1 million. $6.4 million of federal funds and 21 FTEs. So the job that we do to create the great election system in our state, we do that. What I wanted to point out about this slide is the number of FTEs that we have. One of the other questions that came up earlier in the week is some clarification on the number of employees in each of the divisions. I would point out that we ensure the accurate, secure, efficient, transparent, and accessible elections in Oregon with one of the smallest staffs of the public-facing divisions in the Secretary of State agency. We currently have 20 FTEs, consisting of one director, two deputy directors and section managers. There are four members of a voting services staff, eight members of the candidate and campaign services staff, and then we have five FTEs that would fall under administrative, legal, and other category. That's currently where we are. As far as what we do at the Elections Division, we administer election law under the authority of the Constitution as well as the Oregon Revised Statutes. Election Division operates, we also are responsible, for implementation of the Oregon election law as well as federal election law, including the National Voter Registration Act and the Help America Vote Act. I would be remiss if I did not point out that some of that activity requires us to work very closely with our hardworking county clerk offices throughout the state who administer the elections locally under our supervision. Some of the key activities that we do in the election division are listed here. Of course, conduct of elections, the initiative and referendums, campaign finance reporting, voter registration, election law enforcement, candidate services. We do perform training for cities, districts, counties, candidates, as well as political committees. We're responsible for producing, printing, and distributing the statewide voters pamphlet, as well as election information and publications, which currently includes 14 manuals that we produce. Two others have been proposed that we may start to produce soon, as well as two quick guides. So with all of these key activities going on, I've gone on record as saying that I am confident that our elections division was the busiest division of all in the Secretary of State office during 2014.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I guess I'm curious. Your slide talks about, interacting and doing trainings with your team that are the clerks out in the field. And I'm trying to figure out, is there a formal process to reconcile what I'm going to call irregularities, although that has a slightly pejorative term, between county elections and state elections? And let me take it out of the hypothetical and give you a real-time example. In Clatsop County, we had a typo on our ballot, and it was a very significant typo. It left off a decimal point on the amount of a bond measure, so it was a big deal. And there seemed to be a flurry of activity around what the procedure to rectify this boo-boo was. And it seemed to me to be a little tiny bit haphazard, whether or not the clerk has the authority to make that decision, whether or not the Secretary of State has that authority, whether or not county commissioners need to be consulted. And correct my misperception if I have a misperception, and tell me what the rules are when one of these problems with a local ballot arises.
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, Robert Taylor, Deputy Secretary of State, thank you for raising the broader issue of the role of the Secretary of State's office and the county and our county partners in elections.
Let me interrupt you by just saying I'm not being critical of anybody, and I've used a couple of very loaded words. By that, I'm not implying a criticism. I want that backdrop as you answer.
Thank you, Senator. And I'll preface this by saying that elections in Oregon only work if we have strong county partners. And they, we've heard testimony earlier on a bill that's before the legislature from a long-serving clerk in Linn County, and he said that, in his opinion, we have the best county elections officials in the country. And I think he's right. Unfortunately, there are issues like the one you mentioned in Clatsop County, where there was a typo on a bond measure and how it was printed. At that same time, there were a couple of other issues in a couple of other counties. And in that instance, we handled all three of those in the same way, where we directed the county elections officials to print supplemental ballots correcting the specific errors in those specific races. So it is somewhat of a collaborative process between the counties and the state elections office. So it's not uncommon for them to call us and say, hey, we have a issue here. How would you recommend that we fix it? And then we give them advice on how to fix it. Statutorily, the Secretary of State has the authority to issue a directive telling them how to fix it. And we've exercised that authority at times, and sometimes it's good to do that just so everybody's got a clear, written, consistent directive on how to handle the situation. And the other issue with county clerks that's interesting in Oregon is some of them are elected officials under the Constitution. Others are not, because they exist in a home rule county where they are hired by the county commissioners. So they're an employee of the county commissioner and can be hired and fired by them. And so that can add a different element to how we work with those county clerks. So,
yeah, please.
Have you fully articulated that policy and the secretary's statutory authority to your partners, as well as the home rule? Because in the aftermath of the Clatsop situation, and that is a home rule, there was a lot of crankiness about who needed to be consulted and who had final authority on the county level. And it's not your job to tell the county how to communicate inside the county family, but I think a clear articulation of the process for reconciling these inevitable errors might be useful. And maybe all of your clerks in visiting with the secretary are aware of how they should proceed, maybe not so much, and I'm just curious if you could help them at the local level, because this was a weekend worth of kerfuffle that ended with then Secretary Brown, now Governor Brown, exercising her statutory authority. I'm pleased to report the bond measure passed, but it was quite a flurry of phone calls.
Senator Johnson, you are correct, and I was involved in that flurry as well. And I'm happy to say that I think we handled it in the way that was most defensible in the event the bond measure passed.
I agree.
But the other thing that's important to remember is we do meet regularly with our county clerk partners, and we have an active and ongoing conversation with them right now about how we can establish more uniform state standards, but still give them the flexibility to meet them in ways that work best for their local offices. And it's an ongoing conversation that we're going to continue to have with them.
Thank you.
Certainly, Senator.
It's, you know, a different story, but I think another function that you really do serve is that it's interpreting the Oregon's election laws. And this actually occurred in my district. A candidate was defeated in a primary election, but the candidate also got the most write-in votes for another party that didn't have a candidate in that primary election. And the county clerk in question decided that candidate who had been defeated in the primary could run in the general election as a full-blown candidate. And notwithstanding the election law that says you can't do that. And Mr. Williams's predecessor disabused that county clerk of that, but it apparently took him about an hour and a half, but he got it done. You know? But anyway, so I think that's a timely clarification prevented something coming out on a ballot that would have been a complete wreck.
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, yes, that is another one of our main functions, is to help our county partners consistently interpret and implement the laws.
You know, I apologize for having had to step out for a minute, but, and I don't know if this has come up, but Senator Whitsitt's point is actually well taken. We are in a position now in Oregon with having, for the first time in maybe ever, but certainly in my history in the state, three major parties certified, now that the Independent Party has been certified as a major party. And this issue of the sore loser law came up because it's unlikely that the Independent Party itself will have a lot of their own candidates coming up in the 2016 cycle as yet. And I do think, Mr. Williams, that I'd be interested in having a meeting with you and hearing your thoughts about how we might start to think about addressing this to make sure that they get appropriate representation, but also we don't end up with a complicated situation related to our, I think, not unreasonable sore loser laws, but we'd have to think about whether we have to regroup on that now that we have three major parties. So that's my only. Yeah, Senator Johnson.
I guess I'm just going to use what you just said as a jumping off point. Now that the Independent Party has achieved major party status, What guidance is your department, Mr. Williams, going to give them as they transition from being a rather freewheeling, you know, staple $600 to our questionnaire to see if we're going to consider you? We don't take write-ins. We count the ballots in our lawyer's office. How are you going to help them amend their rather freewheeling approach to our elections as they fall under the rigor of major party status?
Sorry. I don't mean to be disrespectful. I was nominated by them too. So,
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, I think you do recognize a daunting task there, and I think that the Independent Party has also recognized that there are some unique challenges that come along with the recognition of a major party in Oregon. Of course, they have met the threshold for the time being. According to Oregon statute, we will have to check that again as we get closer to the election day to make sure that going into 2016 they will have retained that status, and we certainly will work with them to make sure that they abide by all the necessary guidelines and rules.
Madam Chair.
Certainly, Senator.
I really think you've hit on something that's very important, because as I reached out in my district to solicit write-in votes that I knew that I didn't know at the time were not going to be accepted, a lot of people that I talked to, I think, believed that they had registered non-affiliated, that they went down to the clerk's office and said, a pox on both of them, I'm registering independent. Boom, they're independent, capital I. And I don't know how the education process of the electorate is going to unfold, that many of those people who thought it was an anathema to be part of a party now have discovered they're part of a party. And I think that they would have really thought it was an anathema if they knew how freewheeling the independents were, like the disallowing write-in candidates. And so watching those numbers, I think, is going to be something of a, as you say, daunting task. And I would just welcome your response, what you're prognosticating for the fluctuations as people realize that they have done exactly the thing that they didn't want to do, which was to become accidentally part of an organized party.
Right. Co-Chair Senator Johnson, I think that's really the job of the Independent Party to handle getting the message out on what people are actually registering for. I will say that in my
You can staple $600 to the letter and see if you get it back, but that's just an aside.
Mr. Williams, you want to add anything else to your response?
Okay.
Just say Nancy. Which is very informal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your last comment is something that has concerned me. Not that I've ever heard you say it before, but that the Independent Party would be responsible for determining whether people who are registered in that party would remain. I'm troubled by that, because especially given what Senator Johnson has just described and what I've heard several constituents tell me, that wasn't their intent, but to leave the responsibility on the party that they perhaps did not want to be associated with, not that they had chosen to not associate with them. It was it's more correct to say they didn't want to associate with any party. So I don't feel comfortable with the logic that you leave it to the party that someone didn't want anything to do with to reach out and say, would you like to re-register, basically, and resign?
Co-chairs, Representative Nathanson, one of the things that I think that we will see, having just recently recognized the Independent Party of Oregon as a major political party in Oregon, I think that has educated the public about just what that party is. And so folks going forward and people currently registered, I think, may have a better understanding of what exactly they have signed up for, and then they can make an informed decision going forward. And people can always change their registration and go from the Independent Party of Oregon to a non-affiliated status. And that's one of the reasons why in the statute, the way it works is the party gets recognized, you know, can be recognized, but then it's subject to a re-verification. It'll be in August. So I think that what Mr. Williams is talking about is it behooves the party to make sure its members know what they are doing, and if they don't do it, shame on that party. But obviously there's a public education aspect to that that's being served by the public, you know, the publicity around the fact that we now have a third major political party. And folks who said, hey, I didn't want to be a part of a party at all, let alone a major political party, you know, they can make an informed decision for themselves. So,
and a brief follow-up?
Certainly.
I have not had to change an address or make any other changes in voter registration in a while. So I haven't personally had to use an online form. I assume it's pretty easy if you find yourself in the voter registration database to just change your registration, or is there a whole lot of extra stuff you've got to enter, you know, key in this and key in that? And is it pretty simple?
Co-chairs, Representative Nathanson, it's a very easy process. We get those comments a lot about how user-friendly it is. Those are changes that you can make online at the voter registration. Very easy, and we're happy to assist you in any way that we could.
Thank you.
Great. Representative Comp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious of how do you begin to go over these issues like this with all the individual county offices. I'm not going to make negative comments about how long it takes Marion County to count their votes, but it fascinates me as an educator how you're going to get your election officers all on that same page.
Co-chairs, Representative Comp, it's a cooperative effort. It's a cooperative effort.
It would
effort.
Have to be.
And we meet with them regularly. We talk with them regularly. And one of the things that we share with them when we meet with them is that is conversations like this, where we say we are hearing from our state legislators that there is a real desire for more uniformity, more consistency about how you handle issues on the ballot, how data gets recorded in counties so that it can be reported to the state, when election results are available. And part of our job is to communicate to the counties that there is this desire out there for that. And what we have been telling them is, cooperatively, we can come up with our own solution and create our own path forward. And if we don't, the legislature will create a path for us and just tell them what needs to happen. So right now, we want to chart our own path forward with our county partners, and we're working hard with them on that.
Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only follow-up I have is some of us are a little bit fanatical about election results, and so we'll sit there on our laptops on any given election night, and I have yet to find one county website that is like another county's website. The terminology is different. The web page, it's like, okay, because I have vision problems, it's like, okay, where am I going to find these results? And so you're looking over the whole page. And A little more, if you want to share with your office, county election officers, a little consistency would go a long ways, because they're a mess. I'm sorry. They're just a plain out mess.
I'm with her.
Co-chair, Representative Comp, thank you. We will pass that on.
Thank you. Senator Woodson.
I would just like to be associated with Representative Comp's. I represent five counties, and it's every one of them is different. Every one of them is just as opaque.
Heck, I only represent two, and they're both in the Portland metro area, and they're different.
And co-chairs, the each individual county develops its own website and publishes it differently, and we try to work with them. From our perspective, as the state, it should all roll up to us, and we should provide a single comprehensive view of the election results, all at the same time with the same information, so you don't have to go hunting around five different county websites to find it. That's ideally how it all rolls up into one and works as a coordinated system. We have the start of that, but we need to do better. We just need to do better with our county partners.
I guess, one moment if I might, Mr. Co-Chair. I guess it does make me wonder, this is clearly not for this year, or even this biennium necessarily, but it does make me wonder whether, Mr. Williams, you and your colleagues might start to think about figuring out whether there's a way to standardize that and whether the state can be helpful to the counties in providing standardized reporting. So that there is consistency, not just for electeds, but for the citizens of Oregon who want to be able to find results easily and consistently and be able to interpret them consistently. So we might have another conversation about that. I'm very glad you brought that up, Representative. Thank you.
Well, and one just last comment on it. I think it is timely because it's not just this generation, and I can't, you know, some people around this dais are a lot younger than some of the rest of us. But as I hear younger people that are really getting engaged in voting and being involved, it's kind of a nice time to really look at some of these things to keep people engaged.
I agree. Coacher Smith, thank you for your patience. You good? Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Williams, thank you for your patience. You got about six more minutes.
Okay.
Since my understanding at this point, Ms. Jensen, is that we don't have anybody signed up. We do have somebody signed up for public testimony. Okay. So, thank you. Okay. Mr. Bovet, Mr. Coyler, are you in the room? Yes. Are you going to want to testify? Or yes, I see a head nodding. Okay, Mr. Williams, I apologize. I'm going to have to ask you to hustle. We can always bring you back in phase two if we need to.
Right, Madam Coacher, thank you very much. I will keep that in mind, and we will hustle through
to
the important points. Then some of the drivers, well, before we leave that slide, I wanted to address and say thank you to Representative Comp for her kind words on Monday about the level of customer service that you get from the elections office, and I would say that's not uncommon. We hear that a lot, and I'm confident and grateful that we have the most dedicated and hardest working employees in the state. Some of the budget drivers for elections, of course, the unknowns, the unknown number of elections, the unknown number of candidates and measures, the unknown number of complaints, and the unknown numbers of lawsuits. One of the biggest factors that I've been faced with since I came here is, of course, the HAVA funds, the Help America Vote Act funds, that will be exhausted probably sometime in the next biennium, but continue to remain something that we stay focused on and are very much aware of. The next few slides are the packages that we have, package 200, package 201, and package 202. Most important one, I guess, with the time constraints that we have would be, I would want to focus a little bit on package 202 concerning the ORSTAR. I know we had several questions that came up earlier in the week, and I wanted to provide some answers to those. The ORSTAR application began in 2007 with two modules. Now it's 8 years old and has eight existing modules with two more that have been identified as necessary, as a necessary part of the process. Some of the questions that came up that I wanted to point out is the number of users of ORSTAR. There are approximately 10,000 registered users of the ORSTAR system. That includes 5,200 committees that have cycled through, currently 2,200 current open committees. Over 1.7 million transactions have been filed in the ORSTAR system to date. 1,796 voters pamphlet filings have been processed as well. I have some other statistics there that I won't share now, but happy to share with you if the committee would like to see them at a later date. The key performance measures for the Elections Division, we have three. First of all, number eight, sufficiency of campaign finance filings, 98.7% of committee filings determined to be sufficient. Key performance measure number 10, customer satisfaction. We do plan on having a comprehensive survey to happen sometime this year so that we could have some statistics for that performance measure. And then finally, key performance measure number 11 is the number of campaign finance proposed penalty notices. 99% of all PPNs in 2014 were issued timely within 5 months as required. The Elections Division continues to do new things and to have new ways to engage Oregonians. We are partnering with groups to produce and distribute voting materials for disabled voters. We have a new staff position entitled a voter engagement advocate that we're very proud of that will help us to continue to engage Oregonians. Some of the new ways that we're delivering results.
Mr. Williams, I'm going to have to interrupt you for 1 second. Senator Johnson.
What exactly is the job of the voter advocate?
Voter engagement advocate really is an outreach specialist that concerns Senator Johnson, co-chairs, the concerning basically the services that we offer to disabled voters, ways that we can improve the county's services that they provide in doing that, the online ballot that we offer to our military and online military and disabled voters is a big focus of his job. Also ways, new ways to reach out and engage civic groups within the community. So it's a very wide-ranging job, set of responsibilities that fall under that category that we're taking very seriously.
Well, who does that person answer to?
Senator Johnson, that position currently answers to our Deputy Director of Voting Services, Cody Trudell.
Well, is the position filled right now? Is it a double-filled position? Or is it the creation of a new position?
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, this is currently filled, a full-time position. It replaces a former part-time position that we had, so we have increased and made it a full-time position. It is currently filled and staffed.
Thanks.
Keep going, Mr. Williams.
Finally, I would just say some of the new ways that we're innovating for the future. A big focus of ours is using technology to improve the accuracy and integrity of our voting rolls. And finally, as you've heard a lot about, implementing a new motor voter registration to everyone interacting with the DMV who is not registered to provide more access to election ballots. So the Elections Division continues to be a very active and busy division for the Secretary of State, and with your support, we look forward to continuing our excellent customer service. Thank you.
So, Madam Co-Chair,
next week.
Yeah.
So, I would share with you just, and with the committee, each one of us have a different perspective. Mine's been very positive. Whether it's putting together the campaign materials for the voters pamphlet, or having our financial people dealing with, you know, the CME reporting, it's always been very positive. And so please send the message back that we appreciate the good work that's being done.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Smith. I appreciate that and be happy to share that with the staff.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think, okay. Thank you, first of all, and I apologize for making you I'm aware that we have not yet covered the Administrative Services Division of the Secretary of State's office, Mr. Taylor, and we are about out of time, and I'm going to ask as many committee members as possible to stay for another few minutes so that members of the public can testify, because that is important to us. I will have an offline conversation with you. I think we'll probably bring you back briefly next week if we could, Mr. Taylor. I'm very sorry to have
to
do this.
That'd be a good idea.
But we'll bring you back next week to make sure that we get in the Administrative Services Division. We do have a load of bandwidth through that, and I apologize for it, but I am grateful to the committee for some, I think, thoughtful questions over the past several days, and I think it's been informative for our newer members and even for those of us who've been doing this for a while. So, okay, with that, thank you very much, and I would like to invite Rob Bovet and Alex Kyler, who were here, up to speak with us. Thank you. And committee members, if you have to go, no problem. If you can hang out, that would be great. Thank you. And thank you, gentlemen, for your patience. I thought it was important to get the committee members' questions answered, too, but you have our undivided attention.
Thank you, co-chairs. Steiner, Hayward, Smith, and members of the committee. I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I promise to be quick. The Board of County Commissioners has taken a position on that last bullet item about the motor voter registration to support the bill only if funded. I testified in rules about lack of language in the bill that would give me any sense of assurance that there was adequate funding for the measure. I did note in the analysis from LFO on that bill that there was a statement that the additional funding would appear either in the Secretary of State's budget or in an end of session budget bill. I can't tell from the bill in front of us today whether that funding is in there or not, and I'd love to be able to tell my Board of County Commissioners about that. We are, as the committee knows, nervous about funding issues, and since both the Elections Division comes out of our general fund and much of our public safety system comes out of our public our general fund, there's sort of a competition there that is difficult for the board to discuss, and I'd like to get some additional information if possible.
Thank you, Mr. Kyler. I cannot presume to speak for the final budget, except I can say, because Senator Devlin and Representative Buckley, the co-chairs of Full Ways and Means, have made it clear both to Co-Chair Smith and myself and in the Full Ways and Means Committee when we heard this bill prior to moving it out of Full Ways and Means, that there's a strong commitment to provide as much funding as humanly possible to support the counties if we pass this bill. That being said, I don't know what that number is, and I'm not going to make a promise I don't know I can keep. I can promise you, because I will keep this promise, that I am committed to advocating strongly. And I also know that the Secretary of State's office has expressed significant interest in using HAVA funds to offset some of the other county costs that currently the counties are absorbing. And I hope that you've been in conversations with Mr. Williams about that issue. So I cannot make you any promises, except that I, and I know my co-chair and others, are advocating strongly to help support the counties with this transition. That's the best I can promise you. So.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bovet.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet here representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. You've already heard me on this, but I want to emphasize two points. I would say ditto to everything that Mr. Kyler just said. We have a strong vested interest in ensuring that this be funded. Two points. There's been a lot of conversation in the building about the accuracy of the LFO estimate for the fiscal impact on counties. It's not high. It's not low. We think it's accurate. That's what should be funded. Second, I strongly encourage you to fund it as an amendment to this bill. Don't let it wait till the end of session.
Your point is well taken, Mr. Bovet. Mr. Taylor, did you want to add something? Thanks. That'd be very helpful.
Robert Taylor, Deputy Secretary of State. I want to echo both of the previous two witnesses. No matter how you feel on the merits of House Bill 2177, I think it's important that it be funded fully so that our county partners and the state can implement it as intended. I grew up in Southern Oregon. That's a timber-dependent county. I understand the issues in Lane County. It's very, very important. We have to do right by our county partners. And also, I would strongly encourage this committee to please fund this through our budget bill so we can get started implementing this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Taylor. That would certainly be my preference as well, and I will be doing what I can within my power to make sure that that happens and figure out as many mechanisms to get the funding as possible. Anything else before we adjourn, committee? If not, I'm closing the public hearing, and we are adjourned. Thank you very all very all very. If not, I'm closing the public hearing, and we are adjourned. Thank you very